Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish. The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov. Apparently Tel Aviv has been ranked as the fifth best city for Airbnb.
Oh, wow.
Across the world.
Very nice.
Now, when we say the fifth best city for Airbnb, we're talking about for the owners and not for the people who actually go and stay in the Airbnb properties.
Okay.
And what this really means is that the amount of money that an Airbnb owner can get by renting their property out through Airbnb rather than by renting it out on a long-term rental is in Tel Aviv apparently the fifth best factor, if you compare it, the fifth best in the world. Apparently, Airbnb rentals can achieve something like $7,000 a month for owners of properties in Tel Aviv, as opposed to a factor of something like $4,500 a month if they rented it out on a long-term rental. So for owners of properties in Tel Aviv, apparently, it's very, very worthwhile to rent your property out through Airbnb rather than a long-term rental. And by the way, Jerusalem doesn't come too far behind in 10th place on the list. So also Jerusalem property owners are apparently doing very well out of Airbnb. And apparently it's not automatic that you can get more money through Airbnb than you can get through a long-term property rental. And the example that was cited in the article that I read was Hong Kong, where apparently a monthly rental, you can get $3,500 a month, as opposed to something like $1,700 a month if you rent it out with Airbnb. Of course, the risk with Airbnb is that your property can stand empty for weeks and weeks and weeks while people don't come for one reason or another, particularly in places like Israel, where a slight shift in security arrangements could scare people away from coming over tourists. I mean, a lot of the Airbnb properties obviously rented out to tourists. But apparently Airbnb is doing pretty well even over the period of the pandemic in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
That's amazing. Well, to some extent I get it, because maybe people would rather, if they are traveling there, stay in their own place and not in a hotel where there's other people around who could potentially be infectious.
I think that Airbnb and the idea of having your own place and privacy around you rather than having to share your facilities and be dependent upon service in the hotel and things like that has really become a thing. I think that a lot of people just prefer to go and get an apartment and you can kind of take over the place and do as you wish. And if you want to get a takeaway, you can go to some local place to eat out and you don't have to rely on hotel facilities. It's really become a thing. People really like it. And it's not only about the pandemic, but obviously over the pandemic, it's been much simpler and much people have felt a lot more safe by going to a private, in inverted commas, private apartment rather than going to a public facility like a hotel. I do get it.
Absolutely right. Somebody obviously who didn't stay in an Airbnb, I would imagine, is Naftali Bennett when he went off to Bahrain. Apparently it did, however, upset Iran. What's going on here?
Yeah, the Iranians apparently are feeling something of a threat by this visit that Naftali Bennett completed yesterday to Bahrain. He met with the King of Bahrain. He met also with the Crown Prince, who also acts in the capacity as Prime Minister of Bahrain. He met with the Foreign Minister and various other members of government. And we understand that a lot of his discussions that were held, we know that there was this memorandum of understanding that was signed for technological operation to cooperation. And we know that there was a lot of economic discussion that was held in order to try somehow to bring closer together the two economies. But apparently the main item of discussion on the agenda was really Iran, the security threat that exists in the Middle East at the moment. And apparently the Bahrainis are feeling it as much as Israel is, and the Iranian threat. And the reports coming out of Iran suggest that the Iranians also understood that this was really what was on the agenda and feel somewhat threatened by the increasing cooperation that we are seeing amongst countries within the Middle East, especially amongst countries that you would never have dreamed 5 years ago would be cooperating with each other, countries that never had diplomatic relations with Israel, and all of a sudden now there's been a huge outbreak of establishment of diplomatic relations, particularly between Israel and Arab countries around the region. And those new cooperations that have been developed now seem to be very much targeted against Iran. One might even suggest, and I think there would be a good case to argue, that the Iranian threat has been more of an instigator, more of a factor in creating an environment for Israel to become diplomatically connected with these Arab countries I think, you know, there are people within the US administration now and previous administrations that might stand up and say, well, it was because of our good work that eventually peace has broken out. But I think that the threat of Iran has probably been the biggest push towards the Abraham Accords than any other single factor. And just on this similar subject, I was somewhat amused to read that Israel had decided to send a team of diplomats to Vienna, where the Iranian nuclear discussions are taking place between Iran and the P5+1 countries, of course, especially the United States, because the United States is currently withdrawn from that agreement, and the discussions in Vienna center around the United States returning to be a party to that agreement. And we understand that Iran has been really angered by the appearance of this team from Israel, who, of course, are not a party to the discussions and are not a party really to anything that's going on, but have nonetheless sent this fairly high-level delegation to Vienna to be on the edges, on the sidelines of these discussions, apparently meeting with all the members of the P5+1 countries who are party to the discussions. In particular, the Israeli delegation met with the Russian ambassador, and the Russian ambassador actually tweeted a picture of him meeting with the Israeli delegation. The Israelis also put out a photograph and a response on Twitter. Russian Ambassador Mikhail Ulyanov had a picture on Twitter which was labeled "Israeli colleagues from their capital and their permanent mission in Vienna visited us today. We discussed IAEA-related issues," of course returning to the International Associate for Energy, the nuclear facility, the nuclear body that is based there, and they discussed, of course, those issues. And it was interesting that that all went out on Twitter very, very publicly indeed. And the Iranians are angered by all of this. It's interesting that they are responding, because as of up until now, Iran has had a very, very cool face and very, very, very calm, and you know, not being very public in responding to these things that are going on. So the visit by Naftali Bennett to Bahrain, which seems to have been a very, very successful visit, and of course the meetings in Vienna with the International Atomic Energy Agency and the parties around the discussions with Iran have apparently gone down like the proverbial lead balloon.
Yeah, there's a
as
shock.
Far as the Iranians are concerned.
No surprise there. Intel has acquired Israeli chipmaker Tower Semiconductors for $5.4 billion. It's just incredible, these numbers.
The numbers are incredible, and the story is quite an incredible story, because, of course, Tower Semiconductors is not a new company. It's been around already some years, based in the north of Israel, and it has a production facility. It's a company that really produces what would be considered to be at the lower end of the technology range as far as chip making is concerned. The chips that Tower produces are not the most sophisticated chips that one might find. Their production facility in Migdal HaEmek, and they are producing what's called analog chips, which are really chips that are used for a range of uses, including in the defense industry, in computer vehicle communications. But these are chips that are mostly used to monitor electronic sensors for temperature, for weather, for exposure to light, reading security cameras, identifying passers-by, monitoring energy consumption in cars, gas sensors for industrial plants, x-ray sensors in the medical. So it's really mostly focused in the sensor industry rather than the type of chips that we see now in the newest computers, which are really much more sophisticated than that. And Tower had been through a real dip in its fortunes until the new CEO was brought on board in the form of Russell Ellwanger, an American Mormon who was convinced to take over the helm of Tower Semiconductor, having been in the industry. And he's been there for the best part of 10 years now, and he's driven Tower's fortunes upward, managed to expand their revenues this year. Tower will report revenues of something like $1.5 billion, with the operating profit at around about 15%. So it's really done well for itself. And of course, during the period of the pandemic, there has been this massive shortage of chips in the industry in general, and it's caused a backlog of supply in many, many industries, including car manufacturers and many others as well. So Tower has really benefited. But the price that Intel was willing to pay was a massive premium to the market price of Intel. The $5.4 billion that we're talking about represents a price per share of around $53, when actually the company was trading at around $33 before the deal was announced. So something like an almost 50% premium that was paid on the market price of Tower. And Tower's been a really a great story because, as I've said, it's been from a really low point about 10 or 12 years ago to the point now where it's managing to command $5.4 billion from Intel. We do understand that Intel have the strategy of trying to get into the chip manufacturing area. They already have a chip fabrication plant in Israel in Kiryat Gat. So this will be their second chip fabrication venture in Migdal HaEmek, which will become Intel's second major chip fabrication plant in Israel. The deal is supposed to take about a year until it closes, so there still are many risks involved in terms of the deal going ahead, but really a great piece of news for the Israeli industry and, of course, for Tower and its shareholders in particular.
Absolutely. Just I absolutely love these stories. There was apparently a minor earthquake in northern Israel yesterday. We've been speaking quite a lot about these earthquakes. Was this whole earthquake warning system set up? Did it work?
So there were actually two earthquakes, one early in the early hours of this morning as well, as one yesterday. The earthquake warning system was not triggered. And the reason that it was not triggered is because the magnitude of the earthquake didn't quite get to the point that triggers the warning system. Yesterday's earthquake was around 3.5 on the Richter scale. The one this morning was slightly less, even around 3.1. So as a result of that, the earthquake warning system wasn't triggered, because I think that needs to be at a level of 4, maybe even 4.5 before it is triggered. And the epicenter of these particular quakes were around about 15 kilometers northeast of Beit Sha'an in the Jordan Valley, where the two big tectonic plates come together on the fault line in the Jordan Valley, the Arabian plate and the African plate. That's where they come together and they rub up and cause instability in that particular region along that fault line. We understand that in that particular region as well, the African plate is being split into two subplates. So there's a lot of seismic activity as a result of this, these plates rubbing up against each other. And as we've said before, this is a story that we're going to have to keep monitoring for some time. This is already something that people are expecting, because, you know, apparently the next big quake is definitely on its way. And of course, evidence of it in terms of these seismic activities that we're experiencing, not only in northern Israel, but indeed there's been quite a lot of seismic activity to the west, which is on a different fault line, one that runs through Cyprus and Greece. So this is all still ongoing, and we will keep monitoring all of that as time goes on. And just one quick piece of news that I saw earlier is the fact that Nancy Pelosi is apparently set to visit Israel later today. Apparently she will visit the Knesset. She will be welcomed in an official ceremony. She is a slightly controversial person, of course, being the leader of the House in the United States.
And she's got two sets of eyebrows, which is very confusing as well.
Yeah, the House Speaker, I think they call her. Mm-hmm. She's met with Yair Lapid in the past. She's maintained very, very good and close relationships with the American Jewish community. She's stressed on multiple occasions her support for Israel. And I think her father was somebody who, when he was involved in politics back in the day, I think also very much supported Israel, came out against the president of the day, supporting Israel. But of course, with her record in the Trump administration and the way that she really opposed all of the activities that former President Trump did, and the fact that he was considered to have been a real supporter of Israel, and he undertook many activities which were very much supportive of Israel, we kind of wondered where Nancy Pelosi stood on the whole Israel issue. Now that Trump has his administration is historical and she's into a new administration, I think she's been able to demonstrate a little bit more the support that she claims for Israel. The fact that she claims that her support for Israel, she says, is in our DNA. And then, of course, she spoke about the fact that her father pushed President Roosevelt then to support the creation of the State of Israel when this vote was taken back in 1947. So, Nancy Pelosi will be here. She has met recently also with Defense Minister Benny Gantz during the time that he was in Israel. They spoke about the emergency fund that the U.S. administration approved for the funding of the Iron Dome defense missile system. So she has a certain relationship with Israel. It's going to be interesting to see how her visit goes down today over the next coming days. Yeah. And of course, we haven't spoken about Corona, and we haven't spoken about the tensions in Ukrainian border.
Has there been any shift there? Are Israelis returning home to Israel from Ukraine? This is something I wanted to check with you.
Yeah, I mean, there have been dribs and drabs. I don't think that the return to Israel from Ukraine has been quite of the magnitude that people had expected and thought would happen with the tensions going on there. It's currently unclear where things stand. Today was the day that was labeled as being the day that the Russian forces would attack. We understand that even though some of the Russian forces have been pulled back from the Ukrainian border, there are still something like 150,000 Russian troops that have taken up attack positions along the Ukrainian border. The most recent reports suggest that Russia may well also invade Moldova, Moldova being a little bit closer to Israel's heart, given that our Minister of Finance, Avigdor Lieberman, that's his home place. That's where he hails from originally. So I'm sure that there will be some sensitivity around that for him, but certainly a lot of tension, not as many Israelis returning as we thought would, but Israel, of course, standing by and watching to see what moves the Russians will make next.